Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Gender Studies. I'm Julie Fetty, the host of the channel, and today we'll be talking to Denise Brennan about her new book, Life Interrupted, Trafficking into Forced Labor in the United States. Denise Brennan is Associate Professor of Anthropology at Georgetown University, and she is also the chair of that department. Welcome, Denise.
Thank you, Julie.
I wonder if you could begin, Denise, by telling us a little bit about your background, your research interests, a little bit of a biography, if you would, for a few minutes.
Great. Well, thank you for having me on. My background is as an anthropologist working with a group of sex workers in the Dominican Republic who were peer educators, real leaders in their community to fight for their workers' rights. So I definitely see this book about extreme exploitation of workers in the United States as continuing my interest in workers' protections and workers' empowerment.
Okay, so how did you come to write Life Interrupted, in a sense of what were the main arguments that you wanted to make?
Well, I was finishing up that first book on the Dominican Republic, which is called What's Love Got to Do with It? And around the year, in the late 1990s, the United States was drafting legislation to protect trafficked persons in the United States, which eventually was enacted in 2000, and it's called the Trafficking Victims Protection Act, which is the TVPA. And because of different working groups I was in with human rights lawyers regarding sex worker rights protections, I really had a front row seat to how the TVPA was being crafted and the fights over leaving sex workers protected. In other words, people who had knowingly migrated to the United States to sell sex, but their situation of work turned into a situation of exploitation, would they or would they not be eligible for protections under this new piece of legislation? So I was very fortunate to be part of those working groups and to watch these ideological battles unfold. And it became very clear to me that as an anthropologist, my intervention could be to see how people fare after forced labor, after trafficking, if they were going to be entitled to some social benefits as guaranteed under the TVPA and chose to resettle in the United States, how would their lives unfold? And that's how I came to think about this book as focusing on life after trafficking.
Okay, and indeed, most of the thrust of your book is about life after trafficking. But before we get into that, I wanted to ask you about the TVPA and the people that you were able to meet and interview. This is an ethnography in many senses of the term. You meet many people, victims, organizers, advocates, and I wonder, is your research here for this book focused around people who did obtain that kind of protection with the T visas, I believe, or do you enlarge the research scope to include other victims of trafficking?
Right. So a quick overview of what trafficking is. Trafficking, the term obscures what's going on. It's really about migrant exploitation. And the TVPA protects migrants who come to the United States, some with visas, some without, and find themselves in a situation of what the U.S. government calls severe exploitation. Their cases have to rise to a situation which the U.S. government defines as having included force, fraud, or coercion. So these workers' cases need to be proven to be somehow extraordinary. And the TVPA allows for a new visa to be given out called a T visa or trafficking visa to these non-U.S. citizens so that they can stay in the U.S. After their situation of exploitation. The dirty little secret about T visas and the TVPA is that although the legislation allows for 5,000 visas to be given out every year, and it is the year 2014, and the legislation passed in 2000, so we've had 14 years to give out 5,000 visas each year. Up to this point, only 3,369, in other words, under 4,000 T visas have been given out in total to date. So, and we'll talk, Julie, about why that is. But I wanted to focus the book on these, you know, rare recipients, frankly, of the T visas. But at the same time, talk to other migrants who were abused, who did experience exploitation in their workplace, and also those in migrants' rights communities who are fighting for their rights, in order to get a full picture of just how commonplace exploitation is in workplaces that are low wage and generally unprotected and that have a number of migrants working there.
Okay. So let's start with your subtitle, Trafficking into Forced Labor in the United States. In your introduction, you do elaborate quite a bit on what is trafficking, what is forced labor. Not necessarily the same thing, right? One can be trafficked, but not put into forced labor, right? One can be in forced labor without having been trafficked. Can you elaborate a little on that for us?
Well, actually, I talk about trafficking into forced labor to emphasize that trafficking is about labor exploitation. There have been many terms to describe this situation of severe exploitation. The U.S. government and some NGOs around the world talk about this as modern day slavery, and I'm very clear that in the United States, this is not slavery. Slavery is not the law of the land. It's not encoded in a race-based enslaved law. We don't have fugitive slave courts. We don't have, fugitive slave patrols. One is not born into this situation of exploitation. And one does not wait to be sold at any moment. These are all characteristics of what we know to be chattel slavery. And this is why I'm very careful in the opening of the book to set up what these terms in different laws, both international protocols and our own TVPA here in the United States, what these terms capture and what they leave out. And I use the term trafficking because the U.S. government uses it, but I also use the term forced labor to remind readers that this is about a labor issue.
Mm-hmm. And so trafficking does forcibly involve undocumented or clandestine migrants. Is that correct?
Right. Well, the U.S. law protects foreign workers that come to the U.S. who otherwise, once found, would be automatically considered criminals because they're not in the United States legally. And in the past, before the law, would be summarily detained and or deported. So the U.S. government talks about this as being victim-centered, that by providing a new visa and some social benefits, much like those that refugees receive, that we begin to recognize these exploited migrants, these exploited workers, as deserving of some form of assistance, since the situation is extraordinary.
And for forced labor, that can also involve U.S. citizens, correct? It's not just limited to undocumented workers.
Well, U.S. citizens don't need a T visa, right? Mm-hmm. Because they're eligible for all different kinds of, in theory, although our social safety net is quite tattered these days, in theory, U.S. citizens do not need a T visa or the social benefits that come along with the trafficking care regime. Individuals, no matter their immigration status, obviously are exploited in a range of labor sectors. And the TVPA addresses specifically those who have been abused in the sex sector, and also anyone under the age of 18. So it provides prosecutors, it provides attorneys with some pretty strong legal tools to prosecute the abusers or the traffickers.
Mm-hmm. And you know, you really, as an anthropologist, you start out your book with stories of real people, Maria, Carmen, Flo, Eva. Can you tell us how that approach, the ethnography of lived experience, then impacts your other analysis, the analysis we're talking about immigration policy?
Yes. I deliberately open the book with a series of stories of the women you just mentioned that have nothing to do with their time in forced labor, to really underscore that the challenges that those who have lived through forced labor face, much like their migrant neighbors, friends, coworkers, and that other than their paperwork, that allows them to stay in the United States, their T visa, that their neighbors and coworkers and friends wouldn't necessarily know that they've been trafficked. And this was a profoundly political move on my part to step away from the sensationalism that often characterizes discussions and media reports on trafficking. There is a chapter in the book, as you know, on life in forced labor to really interrogate why it is that some individuals don't walk through, for example, an open door, and to think through the level of fear that accompanies being undocumented in the United States. But other than that chapter, I wanted to show just the everyday challenges, what I call everyday life work, of composing a life in the U.S. after having lived through a situation of forced labor, and how that is similar and different from the challenges that face other migrants.
So tell us about that continuum you mentioned of coercion. What is it to find an open door but to not walk through it, out of fear, out of threat, out of lack of knowledge? Can you elaborate a little bit more about the different situations you encountered with the people you met?
Right. Well, I argue that trafficking into forced labor needs to be seen on a continuum of everyday forms of migrant exploitation. In other words, there's definitely in the United States, where migrant exploitation has been a part of doing business in certain low-wage work sites, like in agriculture and in domestic work, such that there definitely is a continuum of migrant labor abuse, and trafficking is at one end of that continuum. In this way, trafficking is preventable. If we were to close the FLSA loophole, the Fair Labor Standards Act loophole, that excludes migrant workers and domestic workers or care workers in the home from certain labor protections. If we were to increase health and safety in a number of protections in a number of low-wage workplaces, if we were to regulate international recruiters and the amount of debts that workers accrue, that we would begin to see a reduction in those who are in severe situations of forced labor. And again, this preventability of trafficking is also what distinguishes it from slavery, right? Mm-hmm. And with this continuum in mind, I traveled the country not only to meet those who had T visas, but also the migrants' rights leaders and worker rights leaders in their communities, and to see who's also working and living with extreme conditions, but who may not qualify for the T visa. So to answer your question about why some people qualify for a T visa and why they don't, you know, this has really confounded some of our country's best attorneys. They have to prove that the worker feared retaliation in an extreme way. They have to prove that the worker was coerced. And I was haunted by an image I had of a number of women in particular I met who were in domestic work, who lived and worked in what I think of as apartments in the sky, literally just apartment buildings on the Beltway around the Washington, D.C. area, the suburbs of D.C. They worked in these apartments that remained unlocked when their employers went to work by day, and they were told to not walk out the door, and they didn't. So I really was trying to think through what kept them there. For example, a woman, Elsa, from Africa, who was told, don't use the phone, don't walk out the door, and she didn't. And so her attorney had to prove that Elsa was experiencing this form of force, fraud, or coercion, such that she was terrified to leave. And there are, I mean, in Elsa's case and in many others' cases, there are some textbook methods of control that their employers slash abusers use, such as they take their workers' passports. They limit the amount of money they may have at any given time, including even if they do give them some wages. They severely limit any kind of contact that they may have with the outside world. They also may not allow the workers to have seasonally appropriate clothes. So what happens, Julie, is workers could walk out the door, but the question then becomes, to what are they walking? They have no plan, no passport, no money, no contacts. In some cases, they don't even know literally what state they're in. And so they stay. And I believe that they stay not because they're consenting to this severe exploitation, but they stay as they begin to work out a plan. They stay hoping to get their passport. They stay hoping to get some wages. They stay waiting, as Elsa did, for some kind of new contact to come into her life. And she finally did pick the phone up one day, and she called back home because she didn't know who to call in the United States. And her family in Africa put her in touch with a friend in the DC area who happened to be a radio personality, a radio DJ from her home country. And they hatched an escape plan for her. And on the appointed day, she left the apartment pretending to bring out the garbage, when really what she had were the only set of street clothes that she owned in the garbage. And she left getting into his car. And I think that story really illustrates how trafficked people are severely isolated and know that something's wrong, but have very few resources within their grasp to resolve it.
Well, it's obvious that those are all forms of coercion indeed, but one of your arguments is that the legal system has trouble recognizing that at times.
Yes. I can't tell you how many attorneys I met across the country who had both trafficked clients, so clients that had indeed received a T visa, but also had other clients that they know their situations rose to the occasion of trafficking, but that they just don't either have the evidence or the clients aren't using language that indicates force, fraud, or coercion. So the cases didn't move forward as trafficking cases. The complicated bit about the trafficking law, the TVPA, is that it allows for demonstrating emotional harm or, you know, psychological abuse. It doesn't require proof of physical abuse. In fact, when we think of Elsa in that apartment in the sky, she wasn't locked in. There wasn't a thug at the door with a gun. This isn't a situation of chains and locks. So it was up to her lawyer to prove how terrified she was to walk out that door. And attorneys, you know, really have been stymied despite the allowance in the TVPA to provide assistance for psychological coercion. It still has been difficult to win these T visas. And frankly, many attorneys around the country, rather than have their clients denied, have applied for other forms of immigration relief, such as for a U visa, which generally are visas that clients who are in situations of domestic abuse apply for. And what we do know is that the cap for U visas is met every year, which is 15,000. So we can begin to see that there likely are a lot of cases that would be trafficking cases that their lawyers are using the U visa instead.
Fascinating. Let's talk a little bit about gender, Denise. Tell us about the gendered migration patterns that you took note of.
Right. So I met T visa recipients, those who the U.S. government deemed were trafficked, who came from all over the world and were trafficked into all different kinds of labor sectors. So restaurant work, domestic work, agriculture, sex work, elder care work. And what we know with any kind of migration patterns to the United States is that gender plays a significant role. So a number of those who have been trafficked into agriculture have been men, and a number of those who have been trafficked into domestic work have been women. And gender also shapes the different forms of abuse and power that have been used over trafficked individuals. So, for example, Maria, whose story opens the book with her karaoke machine, Maria is from the Philippines, and she uses singing as a stress buster, as a way to let off steam, but also to really lament how long she's been on the road over, well, the course of her son's entire life. She left him when he was a baby. And she set out, as many Filipina women do, to work as a domestic, first in the Middle East. Eventually she came to the United States with one of her employers. So Maria sets out in the global economy, as so many women have done from her country. So in this way, we see these gendered patterns of about migration. But her abusers also had certain gendered power dynamics in their treatment of her. They really infantilized her and humiliated her and told her over and over how stupid and worthless she was. They would only give her scraps from the table to eat, and sometimes had her eat off the floor. So she endured horrific abuse. What's, I think, really important to understand is that all the individuals I met are highly resourced. They are the ones who cobbled together the resources, the funding, to set out, to put into motion their migration strategy. They're the ones who were able to get the resources together to pay the recruiters, or they're the ones who had the guts to say yes to the family that was inviting them to work for them in Saudi Arabia. And Maria was no exception. And I think that the traffic people I met all experienced what I think of as a tipping point, where on one hand, their treatment looks just like it did in the same jobs that they occupied back at home. In Maria's case, she was used to being treated like a subordinate by the wealthy and powerful family she had worked for as a domestic and a childcare provider. But when the family in the United States embarked on this systematic humiliation and also the denial of food and forcing her to, you know, be on call for the children 24 hours a day, Maria knew this was wrong. She knew this was different. And this was a tipping point. I do think that what lawyers then have to show is that these individuals, no matter how savvy and resourceful and risk-taking, they may not have had experience making demands on their employers before. When employers begin to abuse with such cruelty, it can feel that the worker has no place to turn. I actually think that some of the abuse inside families can be the most suffocating, because if you are the only person in that house who is the worker, you don't have anyone else to confide in. Because everyone, you know, the family is all complicit.
Correct. And in contrast to what you describe in chapter one about, for example, the unregulated workplaces like the Central Valley in California, where despite horrible abuses and exploitation, there is a sense of working together with co-ethnics or having people around you in the field, right? At the same time, you mention in chapter one that some of these unregulated workplaces, like the Central Valley, are more dangerous for undocumented and abused workers. And can you explain this paradox for us?
Yeah, so as I mentioned earlier, I traveled the country to meet the T-Visa winners, the T-Visa recipients, and I met them, I should spell out, I met them through their social workers and attorneys. There are no communities of trafficked people. They're not resettled in any one place like refugees are. So I very much had to rely on introductions from their social workers and attorneys. Some of those T-Visa recipients are activists themselves now and leaders in their communities and are very involved in different community-based organizations. So I spent a great deal of time at these community-based organizations, and in addition, met leaders in these in various migrant communities to begin to understand the kinds of everyday forms of abuse that unfold. And I argue in the book that it's in these low-wage workplaces like agriculture, where sometimes it's hard to see if everyone is not getting treated well. How do you separate lousy work from really lousy work from work that rises to the occasion of trafficking? And in some places in the country, particularly in isolated places where agricultural workers are using, it seems as if organizers talk about how, you know, exploitation is just rampant. But paradoxically, they've also argued that as workers who don't have documentation in the U.S. Strive to remain unnoticed by ICE, which is Immigration Customs Enforcement, that in some ways they'd rather work for less pay and some, if you will, mild forms of exploitation like wage theft in isolated areas where they know ICE is not likely to come than to live and work in places where there have been where there has been a large ICE presence. And the large the backdrop to the book is our punitive immigration regime. As you know, we just passed in April the 2 million mark of individuals who have been deported since President Obama took office. And as you know, we have a series of state and local laws that empower local law enforcement to enforce immigration law, like 287G agreements and Arizona-style state laws. And as you know, once somebody is found to be undocumented by law enforcement in this country, there's no going back. And many, particularly those who can't pay bond, end up detained and in some kind of proceedings on their way to deportation. It is in this environment that workers who experience some abuse that they think they can tolerate keep on working and tolerating it. many workers, many migrant workers in the United States have terrific debts. They have debts to their families back home who financed them getting here. They have debts to international recruiters. And then those who are in situations of trafficking find themselves in often in a situation of trumped up debts or bogus debts that their traffickers tell them that they have. All of these conditions, both our lack of immigration, our lack of any kind of immigration relief, and these monumental border crossing debts that individuals endure, and then, you know, families that are waiting for remittances on the other end. This all conspires to keep workers normalizing in many instances, you know, some forms of exploitation.
Denise, is this situation what the term Juan Crow was invented to describe?
Well, there have been more reports than I can count, particularly from fantastic outfits like the Southern Poverty Law Center, that for decades have been showing the systematic exploitation of particularly brown workers in the South. And the Southern Poverty Law Center has used that term, Juan Crow, as have a number of other civil rights organizations, to really emphasize the continuing kind of racial profiling that has gone on and systematic discrimination based on race from the Jim Crow era. And there are some real striking quotes in a number of Southern Poverty Law Center reports where migrant workers talk about not feeling like they can go anywhere without being without risking being profiled and possibly picked up by the police.
How do you explain this increase in workplace raids and deportations under a Democratic president, Barack Obama?
I can't explain it. The policies around immigration have been really brutal. And this is why I cannot delink the very the real paltry number of T visas that we've given out under 4,014 years. I can't delink this from this larger immigration vacuum where we have at least 11 million people working and living in the shadows. It is shameful that we've only given out 4,000 T visas, and it is shameful that members of the community where I live in Northern Virginia and possibly where you live in Houston, Julie, members of our communities fear going to work. They fear picking up their kids from school. We cannot fight trafficking in this environment of rampant and unfettered employer exploitation and intimidation, because these employers know they can exploit with impunity. Same with landlords. We have one set of government policies that seeks to protect exceptions to our immigration regime, trafficked individuals. And then on the other hand, we have this other set of policies that is the mandate is to find and to deport individuals who are here without status.
Okay. On On page 43, you talk about, you give some figures on numbers of persons trafficked into the U.S. every year, and you estimate that at somewhere between 14,000 to 18,000 persons trafficked into the U.S. every year. I just want to make sure I'm clear on what that means. When we talk again about persons trafficked, we're talking about not well, we have clandestine immigrants who come on their own, right? Do you count them into that trafficking statistic, or is it only those who have sought help to immigrate?
Right. Well, a couple of things. So there are many individuals who end up in a situation of trafficking, right, which again is extreme abuse, which rises to the occasion of force, fraud, or coercion. There are many individuals who have paid smugglers to come to the United States. Smuggling is not trafficking.
Okay.
Trafficking happens when you work under a situation of coercion. So the mere act of paying somebody to come here, right, that's travel. That's not trafficking. The figure you quoted, Julie, the 14,500 to 17,500 figure is an estimate by the U.S. government, mm-hmm. Which I think I'm really glad you brought that up because I think it gives your listeners a sense of how many folks are estimated to be in a situation of extreme labor abuse in any given year. And again, we have to bookend that figure with the 4,000 T visas given out in 14 years. The reality is that labor organizers and attorneys around the country believe that figure to be higher when we see how many work sites are unprotected and unregulated.
Yes, indeed. So let's shift the conversation to a discussion of forced labor in sex work, which is one of your main arguments of the book, I think, is shaped around this question of prostitution and sex work. Tell us about this particular aspect in chapter one.
Yes, I'm very clear that trafficking into forced labor happens in all labor sectors. And under the Bush administration, trafficking into all labor sectors became conflated with trafficking into sex trafficking. In other words, trafficking into one labor sector only. In 2004, under the Bush administration, 58 of the 59 cases of trafficking that were brought forth for prosecution involved sex. So beginning with the fight against trafficking in the United States, we really saw a fight against the sex sector. And as you could imagine, this assault on the sex sector caught up in it a number of individuals who want to work in the sex sector who are not laboring in a situation of extreme abuse. Ever since this, the beginnings of fighting trafficking, I think we've by only focusing on this one labor sector to the detriment of looking for exploited agricultural workers, looking for exploited domestic workers, I think we've lost a lot of time. Just to be very specific, a number of task forces were set up in communities around the country, task forces that brought together law enforcement and first responders like emergency room personnel, housing inspectors, and then also social workers. The law enforcement involved almost all come from vice squads. So what we've been doing is really only focusing on raiding and finding workers in one sex sector. The discussions over is sex work ever a form of work is just a flashpoint. It's a flashpoint in the feminist movement. It's a flashpoint across party lines. The net fallout has been, where we are today with only under 4,000 people being deemed trafficked by the U.S. government.
And indeed, your argument, if I've read it correctly, is that this U.S. policy that focuses on ending demand for sex work forces vulnerable sex workers to go further underground. And it seems that you wish instead to advocate a sex workers' rights perspective instead. Can you explain?
Right. So this idea of end demand is a mantra that is following a law that was enacted in 1999 in Sweden that criminalizes not the workers, but the clients. The sex worker movement in Sweden has been vociferously vocal and clear, as had the peer review research on this so-called end-demand approach, that sex workers themselves have borne the brunt of these sets of policies that make it more difficult to workers to vet their clients ahead of time so that they can stay safe. It's pushed sex workers to work more in the shadows. In the United States, the sex worker rights movement has also been very clear about the dangers of this approach. We see this kind of thinking undergirding condom confiscation that the police use as evidence of intent to solicit. And Human Rights Watch, for example, did a report on the drop in safe sex practices amongst the sex working community in New York when New York instituted using, condoms as evidence of prostitution. Also just from a common sense standpoint, trying to end demand for paid sex doesn't really pass the smell test. It's just folly to think that we're going to somehow end demand for commercial sex. What we need instead is to listen to the workers themselves in these various sex sectors. Listen to farm workers about the pesticides that they're exposed to and what needs to be done to reduce exposure. We need to listen to sex workers about what increases their likelihood of being not paid or exposed to unsafe sex, or at risk for being beaten up. And instead, we've got this law and order approach that pushes workers further underground.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about life after forced labor, which is the thrust of chapters 3 and 4. Can you tell us about what you wanted to achieve in these chapters, and particularly what distinguishes the longer term challenges in chapter 4 called Living the Possible, these longer term challenges that formerly trafficked individuals face compared to their immediate struggles after what I would call their liberation.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you've asked about life after trafficking, since that was the focus of the book. I do think about life after in terms of the immediate aftermath and the craziness and the chaos of exiting forced labor. but then the longer term struggles, which one attorney in New York City calls a trafficking plus. So first, immediately when individuals leave a situation where they haven't been paid, their self-esteem has been crushed, they probably know no one in the United States, they really enter a time of what one woman, Tatiana, who had been trafficked into a strip club in the Midwest, describes as a moment of confusion and fog. She describes seeing through a veil. And I think that's so, you know, achingly illustrative of how it's really hard for these men and women to make sense of the world. And many describe not wanting to tell the attorneys or FBI agents or even the social workers anything about what happened because they have been, well, lied to by their abusers over months or sometimes years, told about how the police will abuse them, rape them, you know, lock them away without a trial. They have a serious distrust of the U.S. justice system. Often these forms of abuse are exactly how their own corrupt police force or the justice system would work in their home country. So they're acting again with a great degree of sense. There's a serious housing shortage for trafficked persons. So there's only one shelter in the United States in Los Angeles that's dedicated to housing trafficked persons. And even then, it's only for women. So we do, unfortunately, see a number of men and women being housed in homeless shelters and domestic violence shelters, which are really quite ill-fitting for this particular population. They don't have anything. Eliza from the Philippines describes not even having a change of underwear. So they become immediately dependent and beholden on everyone around them. And they don't know who to trust, right? They've had their trust so compromised and so taken advantage of by their abuser that their instincts tell them to not take a leap of faith and trust those around them. So it's a very complicated time. One doctor in Los Angeles who works with the clients at that shelter even goes so far as to say she doesn't think that trafficked individuals are even free when they immediately leave because they're left with so little. And in terms of over time, this idea of trafficking plus, I found that the trafficking assistance regime, so the social benefits that they receive, like refugees too, it ends in about a year. So it's the rare individual who is able to go from this housing, you know, in a living in a homeless shelter to all of a sudden having enough money to move into a decent house. Many enter the workforce in the same industry into which they had been trafficked. So generally low wage, and they're treading water, Julie. They're really living on poverty's edge. And what I found is that they face setbacks as do anyone in the low wage economy. But they have, I think, fewer resources than other low wage workers. They're building all their new relationships from scratch. They don't have family here. So they can't even rely on help with, let's say, when they eventually have kids or if they're reunited with their kids, which the T visa allows for dependents to come to the United States. they don't have even, you know, a family member to share babysitting with. So they are, they face the same struggles as their migrant neighbors and coworkers and friends, but without an established deep community and social networks.
Mm-hmm. And here again, you're talking about the happy few who have received these T visas and obtained some kind of normalization and legalization of their situation. But one of the main arguments of your book, I believe, is that this is to the exclusion of thousands, hundreds of thousands of other workers living in conditions of extreme abuse or forced labor.
Yes. Yeah, so at the end of the book, I have a series of policy recommendations that don't just help trafficked people, but lift all boats. So, for example, I recommend rescinding diplomatic immunity for diplomats who abuse workers in their employ. Probably the biggest trafficking case that hit the news in the past year was the Indian consul who was abusing her one of her employees, Sangeeta Richard, and that set off a diplomatic firestorm. I already recommended that we should be closing the loophole in the Fair Labor Standard Act that leaves out agricultural workers and workers working in homes. And we need to regulate the international recruiting mechanisms for temporary workers, or what gets talked about as guest workers here. We also need to support domestic worker Bill of Rights in local and state legislatures. And I think quite importantly, we need to lobby for protection for whistleblowers. Right now, if you are working, let's say, in a crew of strawberry pickers, and you think that some of the workers in your crew are not getting paid, or maybe a woman is getting sexually assaulted. In other words, the front lines often of fighting trafficking, of seeing someone who's severely abused, is by other workers. Well, if they too are undocumented, they have every incentive to not report this, to not go toe-to-toe with their employer, who could not only fire them, but report them to Immigration Customs Enforcement as well. So we need whistleblower protection from fear of retaliation. And there is a piece of legislation called the Power Act, which does just that.
Talk about this scholarly activism, Denise, if you will, before we conclude, this dialectic between theory and action. You're a professor, you're a scholar, you're an academic. How do you see your stretch into advocacy as well?
I don't think you can write about anything touching on low-wage work and individuals laboring without documentation in this country and not see the brutality of our deportation regime, and to not make the connections between individual stories of trying to stay ahead of poverty and stay ahead of being deported, and not, you know, fight for immigration reform. I also feel that it's been a great privilege to spend the past 20 years or so now, first in the Dominican Republic, watching Dominican sex worker peer educators advocate on their own behalf, and now to go to community meetings throughout the country and watch worker advocates advocate on their own behalf. And I think it's my job as an anthropologist to tell their stories and to tell their stories of their own activism, right? And what's really exciting, Julie, is in the past 2 years, a national survivor network of trafficking survivors has emerged. And they are now taking the podium at the same conferences that I go to, and they're telling policymakers what needs to change. They're not just giving witness to their stories of life in trafficking and telling the same, if you will, narratives of victimhood, but instead are trying to shape policy. They're testifying in local and national legislative venues. And I think on a deeply critical level, they're now able to meet one another through this confidential survivor network, through a confidential Facebook page, and conference calls that they have, so that those who are just coming into the trafficking assistance regime, they're not alone. So this is incredibly exciting. It's very different than 10 years ago when I met some of the first T visa recipients in the country, and they were completely alone and were not introduced to other trafficking clients by their social workers or attorneys because of issues of confidentiality. And now social workers and attorneys are able to turn to their new clients and say, there is this national survivor network. Would you like to tap into to meeting some of them? So this is very, very exciting.
It's clearly new and important. And something else I've noticed that is new and seemingly important is this willingness of undocumented and exploited workers to come out into the open in demonstrations and protests in Washington and elsewhere. In the last few years, I think I've noticed it, demanding better working conditions and normalization of their legal status. So I wonder what accounts for that, this paradigm shift of coming out of the shadows. At the same time, we have President Obama, right, with the threat of deportation increased enormously since his term, and yet this willingness to step out of the shadows. How do you see that?
I think it's precisely because with the 2 million mark, it's just gone too far. People have been extraordinarily courageous, including some of my own students. I marched with them from the front gates of Georgetown down to the park outside of the White House back in April when the country ignited and took to the streets and said not one more deportation. I think in particular, young people have been extraordinarily in the forefront and courageous to wage this battle. The so-called dreamers who have been extraordinarily creative eloquent in their demands for a human, a just, you know, reform. I think that a lot of individuals in the country right now who didn't think immigration was their issue, they're now waking up and they're looking around their own communities and they're seeing that vibrant members of their own communities are under assault, and that also families have been separated, that there are just heartbreaking stories of families that have loved ones who are, you know, in detention or have been deported. And I think a lot of individuals and communities across America, they don't want this to be their community.
Well, thank you so much, Denise, for sharing with us your latest book today, Life Interrupted. Just to conclude, will you tell us a little bit about what you're working on now or next?
Yeah. Well, in fact, I wanted to continue looking at how individuals endure under this immigration regime. And I'm going to be interviewing families who are separated by detention and deportation.
Very good. Well, thank you again, Denise Brennan, for spending some time with us today to talk about Life Interrupted.